Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Looking at temperatures in the 30s this morning on this Monday, October 7th. Looking like temperatures are slightly starting to cool down. On the phone to talk to us more about it, I've got meteorologist Nate Larson from ABC4. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Parker. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, we've got a gorgeous day to kick off. The temperatures, of course, cool this time of year for overnight lows. Afternoon highs, though, warming up nicely. We're still above average, actually, with high pressure still in place. So plan on a little bit of cloud cover increasing across Park City throughout the late afternoon and evening. Some moisture rotating up from the southwest. We'll be in the mid-70s, though, for highs. So that's above normal. Usually we're right around 60 degrees in Park City this time of year. We're going to stay above average throughout this week, but we do have a slight chance of a few showers on Tuesday as high pressure stays to the south of us. It is scooping up a little bit of cloud cover, and I mentioned a little bit of moisture could generate an isolated shower or two on Tuesday afternoon and evening. We drop to 73 tomorrow, and then mid-70s. We're sticking around Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We'll start to see more cloud cover by the end of the week. Overall, though, really nice and quiet weather shaping up with low 70s for the weekend. We will start to see a little bit of a pattern shift as a trough moves around the ridge by this weekend, dropping temperatures just a little bit. As far as moisture goes, though, not a huge threat for shower activity. Our best chance will be tomorrow. Heber looking at 81 today, mostly sunny with clouds late today. Partly cloudy skies tomorrow, low 40s for overnight lows, upper 70s for highs on your Tuesday. Plan on an isolated shower or storm possible. Clearing out Wednesday, we'll start to see clouds increase again later in the week for Heber as well. Temperatures in the low 80s for highs, overnight lows in the upper 30s, low 40s. Should drop into the 70s though this weekend, about 76 with sunshine on Sunday. Parker?
Thanks. No, sounds good, Nate. Have a good week.
You too.
Stay tuned. Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith and Chief Deputy Casey Bates will be in studio shortly. They'll share the latest safety concerns in the community and detail ongoing law enforcement training. Then we'll be joined over the phone by Heber City Manager Matt Brower. He'll have details on the City Council meeting this week. And we'll end the hour with Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward. She'll be talking about how residents can get involved in the city's general plan update. Millions remain without power, and more than 200 people have died since Hurricane Helene made landfall September 26th. Two Park City sisters shared their stories of survival with KPCW's Matt Sampson, one who rode out the storm, the other who's locally raising awareness about the need for disaster relief.
Sisters Hannah and Mia Feinsilber were born and raised here in Summit Park before moving to Black Mountain, North Carolina, a small mountain town outside of Asheville. Hannah is a grad student at Utah State University. She says she watched in horror as the scenes of destruction rolled out of western North Carolina.
It's been really difficult seeing your family and everything you love and a lot that you grew up that was very familiar just kind of wiped away, and just seeing small mountain towns just be decimated and disappear.
Hannah says the hardest part was not being able to reach her family as she watched the news with fear and uncertainty.
I've only had very limited communication with my family. Cell service is very spotty. They don't have power. They don't have water. They're not expected to have water for weeks.
Hannah's sister Mia is back in North Carolina. She weathered the storm inside her Black Mountain home. As the sun rose in the storm's wake, Mia said she couldn't believe all of the destruction.
It was kind of horrifying. I mean, just our neighborhood, we had downed trees and power lines all over the road. And then, like, we couldn't even get out. Like, if we wanted to, we were blocked in. And that was scary. And then, like, there's a farm across the road from where we live, and it was just, it had turned into a ginormous river that just was flowing into the street. So it was quite shocking.
The situation remains dire in and around Buncombe County, where Mia and her family live. Hundreds of homes and scores of roads were damaged or destroyed. Mia says the poor cell service and lack of reliable communication has compounded her concerns.
Oh, that's terrifying. And, like, when you talk to people around here, that's one of the big things that, like, you don't know if other people are okay. And so my boyfriend and I, we hopped on bikes to go and make sure we could check on all of our people and make sure that they were okay.
Mia says she has power for now, but the storm surge has left much of the Black Mountain community without water. Those who do have it are under a boil order. Federal relief and resources are starting to reach some of the hardest hit areas. Mia said this is the beginning of a long journey to rebuild and recover.
We have lots of resources coming in, and it's been amazing to see that. But there's a lot of families that lost everything, and they will need help trying to recover.
Back here in Utah, Hannah is starting a donation drive through USU to collect supplies for communities needing long-term support. Hannah said she and her sister are sharing their stories of survival to raise awareness about the need for disaster relief.
Black Mountain is a mountain town like Park City, and mountain towns gotta help mountain towns. And if you can, please donate to local charities.
Information on how to contribute to the North Carolina Disaster Relief Fund can be found at kpcw.org. Matt Sampson, KPCW News.
I'm now joined in studio by Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I've also got two newcomers, Detective Buck Buffton and Sergeant Tim Berger. Did I get your names correct?
You did.
Sure did.
How's it going this morning, you all?
Doing great. How about you?
I'm good for Monday. Sheriff Smith, I just wanted to start, you know, I think many residents are aware of the fire across the county line over there. Just curious how your office is monitoring it and just how involved in any of the response.
Well, we're relatively involved in that the base camp is set up in Francis at the rodeo grounds. So we're monitoring through the base camp, get a daily update. My last update was on Friday. It had burned over 9,000 acres. The cost of it is just phenomenally expensive. It's about almost $4 million to date. It did turn towards Duchesne, so we don't anticipate it's gonna come into Summit, but our heart just goes out to all the people in Duchesne and Wasatch County.
Yeah, and just from a jurisdiction standpoint, does that not really activate a response from your office until it were to cross that line? I understand it's not too close to it.
Yeah, well, we're always willing to help the other jurisdictions, and they help us. If they ask for our assistance, we certainly would respond. But right now, we're monitoring, and the base camp, like I said earlier, is in Summit County.
Yeah. Well, I understand today you all wanted to talk a bit about some training that you have worked on in general. I understand it's called kind of the Safe Wrap system. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, you do. And this is, you know, our greatest concern is taking people into custody safely.
Yeah.
And in an expedited manner where the subject is safe and the deputy is safe. So we're continuing to grow the program, and Sergeant Berger and Detective Buckton are the best in the business, so go ahead, gentlemen.
Yeah, you want to talk about your involvement?
Yeah, we've been actually working this program comes with the Safe Wrap for over 10 years now here locally at the Sheriff's Office, and we've actually been at the forefront of training for what we call GST, or Gracie Survival Tactics, is what we've implemented here locally, and it's probably one of the best programs that we have found for law enforcement, and it's a jiu-jitsu-based program. Which is a self-defense program.
Yeah.
It's specifically tailored for cops. And we've been at the forefront here locally in the state. We're probably one of the first agencies to implement the program full-time for all of our deputies. So you have patrol guys, corrections officers, they've all been through our training regiment, which gives them the upper hand when it comes to dealing with combative subjects or just dealing with somebody who needs to be restrained in a very safe manner that doesn't hurt them and it doesn't hurt the officer or the deputy and anybody involved. We're all on the same page to understand how can we take this person into custody or get them help or even go into the hospital in the safest manner. And we've even brought agencies from across the country here locally in Summit County to train them in this same program. So not only are we doing it for us locally, we're reaching out and reaching a very broad spectrum of law enforcement and showing that Summit County is at the tip of the spear, basically, for trying to implement this program and get it out so officers and people just in the general public, when we deal with them, are handled in the best way. So, and with that comes this patented program that we've now implemented, which we're also going to be first in the state to do, which is called the Safe Wrap system. And I'll let Deputy Buffton talk a little bit more about that.
So last week we hosted a Gracie Survival Tactics Level 2 instructor course in Summit County, and we've hosted them for the past 4 years, Level 1 and Level 2 courses, and this system came out in about April, and it started circulating around social media and everything, and we got the videos, and we knew it was coming to our training, so we weren't skeptical, but we were eager to try it out and see how well it worked. And the instructors that taught the course put both Tim and I into the safe wrap system and the technique, and it's legit. Both of us, you know, fit, work out, train jiu-jitsu and all that stuff. We couldn't get out of it. And the funny thing about it was, we were in such a good position, and we were laid on our side instead of being proned out on our stomach or on our back, that we could breathe really well. We were very well secured, and the more we struggled and fought against it, we just caused ourselves more discomfort while we were doing that. And our plan is to have this implemented, and our deputies will begin training the safe wrap system this month, and we're going to have them starting training, doing it by November. All the deputies at the Summit County Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, well, and I think we all understand jiu-jitsu from a surface level, but is it really just the ability to take someone down with your bare hands? Could you kind of just talk physically about what it allows you to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that it allows us to control a subject without using strikes, without using a baton or a taser, right, and all the things that you see on TV that just look horrible. And you know, when it comes to us wanting to help people or just get somebody safely to the jail, because that's where they need to go, there's two aspects to that. Regardless of which way we go, we want to ensure that our deputies are handling themselves and the public in a way that they're not getting injured unnecessarily. We're not having to hit people, we're not having to put a taser on somebody, because our deputies are comfortable and confident in using their hands and their body and body mechanics to control somebody. And that's what we really like about the program. And as far to my knowledge, since we've implemented this program, our use of force incidences have dramatically gone down. And from what I can gather, I don't think we have a single use of force incident that has come to a negative light to the sheriff's office. Because we just handle people so differently than most agencies, in my opinion. And we're comfortable using our hands and not having to go to a tool to deal with somebody, which is, there comes a time where that's necessary. But in most times, if you just simply understand how to control someone, and that jiu-jitsu part of it just amplifies our ability to do that. Would you want to expand a little bit on that, Buck?
Right. Well, and when he says control, there are no chokeholds involved in this. So no one's ever in jeopardy.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is that you know, for us, this isn't personal, this is our business. But we take someone into custody safely, and once the handcuffs are on, it's over. We get them in the car, we get them to the jail, and that's that. So this is a system that really works well for us. When you look at the statistics, no deputies have been hurt, but more importantly, no one from the public has been hurt. And we've arrested a lot of people using these tactics.
And I understand, you know, obviously part of the objective is to keep the suspect safe. Can you talk a bit about how this helps keep the officers safe in these maybe tense situations?
It's, we've been doing Gracie survival tactics for almost 11 years, full-time consistently in our department as a program. And that's one of the nice things about jiu-jitsu and having it implemented into the GST program in defensive tactics is it really avoids deputies getting injured. As to deputies getting into a fist fight or throwing punches and stuff, which is, there's a high likelihood of injury and it not being effective. And so with these techniques and how often we train as a department, our deputies are very confident, and it's about control and keeping that person under control until we can take them into custody or get them into an ambulance, get them help in some way, because not everyone that we come in contact with is a bad person. It could be an autistic individual, it could be, you know, somebody along those lines that we just have to help restrain and keep them safe and keep deputies safe. And so the system works really well, and the program we utilize.
Yeah, and Sheriff Smith, can you just talk more about why you feel this is important for the department to kind of maintain?
Absolutely. Our goal is to never have to utilize our firearm or our taser. Look, we're well trained in dealing with autistic people, but when you're initially on the scene, sometimes it's hard to determine is this person autistic or combative. That training helps, and sometimes we just have to try and get them into an ambulance to get them the help they need. So this training is cutting edge, and it allows us to subdue people with no one getting hurt, and that's the objective, mm-hmm. right? You know, we're here to serve and protect. And we take that oath very seriously.
Yeah, and you all are speaking very highly of it. Is there any specific reason why you feel other departments are behind or haven't?
Well, I think a lot of it's budget. Yeah. You know, it's expensive to do, mm-hmm. And budget always drives things. But, you know, when we first brought this in, I was new here. This was a program we used when I was with the Drug Enforcement Administration. And the former sheriff, Justin Martinez, was a big supporter. So it was easy for us because we both thought it was a great program. And then these two gentlemen brought it to a whole nother level.
Mm-hmm. And so I think you may have mentioned it earlier, you two involved in training other departments as well outside of Summit County?
Correct. Myself and Buck have gone outside of our county. We've had other agencies reach out to us, say, hey, can you guys come show us what you're doing? Because what you're doing is working. Mm-hmm. And we want to kind of mirror exactly what Summit County is doing. There was one point where the state, the post itself, mm-hmm. reached out to us and said, hey, can you come down and show us what your training regimen looks like? So me and Buck went down and showed our entire program. And luckily, post adopted a lot of the movements, a lot of the control tactics that we've been doing for years. And they were like, wow, this really works. And as me and Buck also teach cadets, mm-hmm. Going through the police academy, and we've seen how this training brings confidence to the table. And that's the biggest thing for most people, is if you're confident in yourself, you don't have to resort to that gun. You don't have to resort to the taser, which we've seen the effects of those things getting pulled out, right? If we can defer and not do that, that's our goal.
Yeah, Buck, you want to talk about what it's been like?
And one of the other things is when training jiu-jitsu, when training in this type of program that we teach for defensive tactics, one of the nice things is it teaches deputies not only control with their hands and their movements, but it teaches them internal control. They're more confident, they're more experienced, they know the moves, and they don't lash out, they don't, you know, use excessive force. They don't do those type of things that can get them into trouble and look really bad on, especially on video and things like that. They're a lot more controlled and patient, mm-hmm. with subjects, and that can be a huge difference on how that incident plays out. We coincide de-escalation and dynamic de-escalation with our training, so that people are well versed and they know how to read people, they know how to talk to them, they know how, and a lot of times subjects will, just by how a deputy carries themselves confidently and with patience and compassion, can de-escalate a lot of those situations.
Yeah,
I think the biggest factor is that in the last 10 years I can't think of one excessive force complaint, and we've arrested thousands and thousands of people. Majority of them go peacefully. But the ones that haven't, I have no complaints.
Yeah.
So obviously the system works.
Yeah. Well, moving on, I did want to ask about, I was told that the sheriff's office is launching an app.
That's correct. We have the sheriff's app. There'll be a QR code that we'll send out. And the app is all-inclusive. The great thing about this app is when you go to it, you can scroll through it, and all the other entities in the county, mm-hmm. are listed within that app. And it'll give you directions how to get there. It'll give you an idea of what they do and how to make contact. The app is phenomenal. Chief Bates is heading that, mm-hmm. up, and has just done a great job implementing it within the county.
Yeah. And then finally, Sheriff, I did want to ask, I didn't know if you two were involved as well, but the emergency training that went on in Canyons Village about, I guess it was 2 weeks ago now. Can you just talk a bit about what the motions you went through during this and just why it's important?
Well, you know, these field training exercises that are all encompassing, it was everyone in the county, from emergency managers, mm-hmm. to fire to police. Yeah. First of all, it gives you an idea, if we have one of these emergencies, how we work together, where the flaws are, what we did well, what we didn't do so well. I wasn't expecting at the end of it to have a mock press conference, which you were part of. And it was just phenomenal because it gives you a great idea. You know, the most terrifying thing in law enforcement is when you come up on something you've never seen before. Well, this gives you an idea. And look, the military has done this for years. You know, the federal government has done this for years. And it was so great to see the two emergency managers, the county and the city, did such a great job putting this on and put so much work into this. I don't think people realize how lucky we are to have those two individuals. They were just phenomenal. And they planned it, they implemented it, and they executed it. And we all learned a lot from it. So yeah. Thank you to KCPW for helping us out.
Yeah, of course. Well, I guess we're a bit running out of time. Is there anything else you want to mention or think people should know?
Yeah, just one other thing. We, you know, unfortunately, because of social media, there's always a lot of scams out there. Yeah. And I've gotten a lot of calls lately. Look, law enforcement will never call you on the phone. We will either show up at your house or send you something in certified mail. So please, if anyone calls you and they will mimic our phone number, they'll go to our website and mention a deputy's name that's there, we will never call you. If they call you and ask you to send them some type of gift cards, please hang up.
Yeah, and is there any kind of reporting people can do? Because I just know personally there's been a few people that have mentioned that has happened to them.
Right. Yeah, you can call our dispatch at 435-615-3601. Make them aware. Most of these scammers are from outside the country. But please, pay attention. If it doesn't make sense, call us. Ask us. Most people, you can call and ask for me. I'll be glad to talk to you. I'm not going to call you on the phone and ask you to send me a Home Depot gift card.
Yeah. No, it's sad, but it's ongoing.
And they prey on and they confuse, especially our senior citizens, you know, who have been just great citizens their whole lives and don't want to break any rules.
Yeah.
And they prey on that. So please, if they call, hang up.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention?
No. Listen. Oh, one other thing. With all the construction going on, and please be patient. We've had more road rage incidents in the last 3 months than we have had all year. Take a deep breath. We live in a great place. All those road rage incidents are always followed by regret. You know, please be patient.
Yeah, that's a good message. Well, appreciate you three joining me this morning.
And, hey, thank you.
Have a good week.
Yep. You as well. Thank you very much.
Been speaking with Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith, as well as Deputy Buck Buffton and Sergeant Tim Berger. I'll be right back. Joining me over the phone, I've got Heber City Manager Matt Brower. How's it going this morning, Matt?
Parker, good morning. I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, so we have a city council meeting scheduled for tomorrow, is that right?
No, it's the first and third week, so it'll be next week.
Oh, my apologies. Well, wanted to catch up on, you know, several big issues going on in the Valley. I wanted to start first with the Utah Department of Transportation. I understand they made an appearance at your meeting last week talking about the future bypass. So can you give us a brief recap of where we're at on that and when we're, you know, you all are expecting potential action? It sounds a bit hazy.
That, quite frankly, is why UDOT came to our meeting last week, is to invest some time in the communication between UDOT and my council. My council had expressed some frustration, and UDOT heard that and responded by coming to the meeting. We still do not know a date for completion of the Environmental Impact Statement, better known as the EIS. We were told last Tuesday that work on the EIS would now continue forward after a brief stop, but we don't know to this date exactly how much more time that work's going to take.
All right, that'll be one to watch. I know a lot of residents are interested there. Moving on, I did want to touch on the proposed Harvest Village annexation. Could you kind of give us some background on where this is at, what's being proposed, and kind of what the next steps are?
The Harvest Village annexation is located in the most northerly part of the North Fields. As you come down from Park City into the Heber Valley, it'd be the area that sits in between Highway 32 and Highway 40. It was actually entitled by Wasatch County about, I think it was 10 or 12 years or so ago, so it's already entitled. They are looking to annex into Heber City. they're looking to have a density that's a bit less than what the county had entitled, but a bit more than what our zoning designations would permit. We had a public hearing on this application last Tuesday. No decision was made. Additional work is being done by staff on what's called a master development agreement. And when the negotiations on that agreement are complete, that will be brought back before City Council for the consideration and possible adoption.
And how does this relate to this new town being proposed, Riverview? Does that have any potential influence on how this plays out?
Uncertain at this time. We do know that the proposed incorporation boundaries of the new town does include two areas in which Heber City has already received annexation proposals. So the process to incorporate a new town requires certification by the county as well as the Lieutenant Governor's office. We do intend to notify each of those entities that the proposed incorporation boundaries include two very active and valid annexations. So it's uncertain at this time as how that may play into this.
Yeah. Well, moving on, you know, with the opening of the Deer Valley East Village, you know, realtors have been quick to label Heber the newest ski town. And with that, you know, short-term rentals become extra important. And I understand you all are starting to look at your policies, typically a heated issue. I'm sure you've gotten a lot of opinions. Based on the last meeting, where are you at with what's being considered?
Yeah, great question. The challenge that we've had is we've received several complaints from neighbors living adjacent to homes that are short-term rentals, either of loud noise late at night, too many people, too many cars. And the other issue is a lot of the ordinances pertaining to short-term rentals are kind of vague, so it's difficult to enforce them. Therefore, my council is looking at trying to amend the policies to take into consideration the complaints that we received and to help my code enforcement department out by making them more enforceable, making them clearer to understand and more black and white in nature.
And I'm just curious, you know, with like I said, with the new side of Deer Valley opening up, I mean, has Heber City seen an increase by any means in short-term rental permit applications?
We have. The challenge that we face on that front is many of the short-term rental homeowners are not following the code and getting a business license. So we're not entirely sure how many homes in the Heber area are short-term rentals. We have approximately 42 homes that have gotten a business license, but we know there's many others that have not. So part of the discussion is how do we find out who is operating as a short-term rental and make sure they comply with the code so it's a fair and even playing ground.
And any set date for when you think this could come back?
Yeah, I believe it's going to come back on, I think it's the October 15th agenda, if I'm not mistaken. Council's going to get some feedback to staff. Staff is going to update the code, and that will be presented to the public on the 15th.
Okay. Well, I did want to ask as well if there was any updates on the community reinvestment area from either the county or the school board.
We are working with both the school board and Wasatch County seeking their support for what's called intra-local agreements that would allow for the sharing of tax increment that would be generated in the CRA area. We're hoping to have this done before the end of the current calendar year. It's critical to our plans to transform our downtown from what has been for the last several decades a pass-through to a legitimate destination community with great dining, great shopping, great entertainment options. So we're working with them in good faith, and hopefully we'll get their support over the next couple months.
Yeah, and I do want to avoid the politics of it, but I'm sure as our listeners were aware, we did a story last week on a Wasatch County Council candidate that was going around spreading rumors around development in the Heber downtown core, and I kind of wanted to offer you the chance to just clarify what exactly is being considered, because there are a lot of talks about property being condemned and being taken by the city and without any compliance. I mean, just what is Heber really looking at doing?
What I can tell you is that the Heber City Council has said on multiple occasions publicly they will not use condemnation to bring about the vision that's included in the Envision Central Heber initiative. In addition to that, the organizing documents for the CRA specifically includes language that we cannot and will not use condemnation. So I'm not sure what the intent was behind that. What we hope to achieve is the creation of a what we're calling a pedestrian plaza, which has been branded as C Street. That will take you from the city's main park, mid-block between Highway 40 and 100 West, up to the block where the Heber City Tabernacle building is located. This block will contain dining, it'll contain shopping, it'll contain entertainment opportunities. If your listeners have been to Pearl Street in Boulder, Colorado, or Duval Street in Key West, Florida, you know exactly what I'm talking about, where you have essentially a large path, pedestrian only, that allows them to stroll up and down that area to go shopping or dining and to just have a great time. So that's our goal, that's what we hope to achieve, but my council has no intention to condemning any property for that purpose.
Yeah, and just, you know, talking a bit more about that project, you know, pretty similar to some of the things Park City is doing right now. I mean, does the city see this as, you know, a way to add more vibrancy for locals? Is it a, you know, also a tourist kind of magnet, you know, twofold? How is the council kind of approaching the goals of this?
This initiative of the pedestrian pathway is a local first initiative. We recognize that tourists and visitors will follow where the locals go. We know that when family visits, the locals will take them to their best hangout places, which we hope will be this pedestrian pathway. So this is most definitively a locals first campaign, but we recognize there are tremendous opportunities with the East Village of Deer Valley and with the Olympics coming up, that this will be a transformative event for our downtown and bring it into a destination.
Yeah, and you know, just to touch on Deer Valley East Village, is there anything the city is doing in particular differently with that base area opening up this winter?
Nothing specific to that, other than what we know is that Deer Valley East Village is going to spin off eventually $400 million of tourism spend. We also know that the visitors there will stay on average of 5 to 7 days, 5 days at the resort, and then 2 days exploring the area. What we hope to do is that they'll come into Heber and spend some time in Heber and not simply stay in Park City. And we hope to have a downtown that will attract them and where they want to spend some time and, of course, drop some money and then go home.
Yeah, and lastly, Matt, I understand there have been, this might be more at the Wasatch County level, but just wanted to ask you as well just about continuing to expand public transportation in the Wasatch Back. Like I said, I understand the county has been kind of leading this, but is the city involved in any level? Would you like to see that grow?
The city is certainly supportive of Wasatch County. We think they've done a phenomenal job with High Valley Transit, particularly with their micro transit. I've heard of several anecdotes of people whose life's been changed by having that flexibility. So Heber City certainly supports it, and we certainly partner with the county on endeavors to improve it and hope that they'll keep growing it and keep supporting it.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention, Matt?
Yeah, one last thing. You mentioned CRA as part of our interview. Heber City is having an open house on Monday, October 21st. We'll have two open houses that day of the same topic. The morning one will go from 11 to 2. The afternoon one will go from 6 to 7:30. We'll have information there about the CRA, about the pedestrian alley, about the vision for the downtown and its transformation. And all of this will be held at the city's main city park under a big white tent facing our brand new main stage, which will be wrapping up its construction here in about 30 days or so.
Great. And that's October 21st, you said?
October 21st. That's correct.
What is their time?
Again, in the morning will be from 11 to 2 and the afternoon from 6 to 7:30.
Great. All right. Well, and is that all, Matt? Anything else?
No, I appreciate you coming on. Thank you, Parker.
Yeah, thanks for calling and keeping us updated.
Of course.
We've been speaking with Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Jumping back into some stories, the end of the growing season is approaching, and Summit Community Gardens and Eats will donate hundreds more pounds of produce this year compared to last year. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Summit Community Gardens and Eats launched the food pharmacy program in partnership with the People's Health Clinic and the Christian Center of Park City in 2023. That year, 1,300 pounds of garden-grown produce was donated to clinic patients experiencing food insecurity. This year, Executive Director Helen Nadel says the organization has already donated 1,400 pounds of food through the food pharmacy program, with lots more on the way.
There are still potatoes in the ground. There are still tomatoes ripening. You know, we're covering those at night very carefully, and they are looking gorgeous. So there's still tons of food coming in.
However, Nadel says the season wasn't always looking good.
I think that frost in July had us a little, you know, had us wondering what was going to happen. But high altitude growing requires a lot of kind of attention and diligence, right? So like checking the temperatures. When is it going to be freezing? When do I need to cover things?
Nadel says the garden staff grows most of the food pharmacy donations, but this year's extra food comes courtesy of local plot gardeners who grew food specifically for the program. Many plot owners would also donate their own fruits and veggies when they had extra. The growing season is soon coming to an end, so the garden is hosting a cleanup day Saturday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Nadel says while the garden is open until it snows, they are inviting plotters to start cleaning up. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
I'm now joined in studio by Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Parker.
So we're here to talk about the general plan today, which is kind of kicking off, and how residents can get involved. But to start, could you kind of speak to what the general plan is and why it matters?
Yes. So Park City is getting ready to update the general plan, which was last completed in 2014. So this is an opportunity that the community has about once a decade to really participate in this community-driven blueprint that helps us envision how the city is going to evolve, grow, and develop in the coming decade.
And you mentioned the last one, was finished in 2014. When you look at that, you know, what are kind of the pillars of that when you review, and just that you kind of can point out?
So the 2014 general plan was based on a visioning, community visioning project in 2009, and the core values that that came out of that was that we should keep Park City, Park City, mm-hmm. the small town.
Character.
Yeah, small town character, protect the natural setting, protect the sense of community, and prioritize historic preservation. And the 2014 general plan has really helped shape a lot of the things that have happened over the past decade. And as we went through the Vision 2020 process, the community visioning process that started before the pandemic and then has kind of carried us through to where we are today, that also prioritized the need to balance visitors and the quality mm-hmm. of life for residents, and also to really embrace bold action, especially regarding transportation and innovative solutions.
Yeah, so that really weaves into how, you know, a lot of decision making around planning and broader topics. But so I understand there's going to be a set of 10 committees that for each different neighborhood that you're establishing. And is it three residents each you're looking for from each neighborhood?
That's right. That's right. So the general plan process, there will be a lot of opportunities for the community to engage and provide input for the city as a whole. And then our current general plan identifies 10 neighborhoods within Park City. And Old Town is very unique from Thanes, or mm-hmm. the Quinns Junction neighborhood has really transformed since the last general plan project. So these neighborhood advisory committees give residents an opportunity to help facilitate neighborhood meetings mm-hmm. and discussions to really learn about some of the challenges and opportunities that we can explore through this process.
Yeah, and, you know, just generally, on these committees, you know, if you compare a Thanes to an Old Town, you know, obviously a Thanes is probably not going to change as much in the next 10 years. I mean, are kind of some of the questions and topics you'll be discussing the same across the board, or do you think it'll be a little different just based on each neighborhood?
I think it's going to be really interesting, and I think it will be different based on each neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I also think in our 2014 general plan, there are some neighborhoods that are identified as great locations for nightly rentals, but really over the last decade mm-hmm. have transformed into neighborhoods with primary residents. So yeah. It will give us an opportunity to check in on what the recommendations were in 2014 and then to see if residents feel like that's still the direction that they want their neighborhood to head down, or if there are opportunities to update those plans.
And the city just completed that small area plan for Bonanza Park. Will that kind of weave into that, this process regarding that neighborhood specifically?
Yeah, and the Bonanza Park small area plan, that will be a key document as we go forward in the general plan process to update the recommendations for that neighborhood. Really, the small area plan recommends that become a neighborhood for locals. And we do have a number of residents who are in the neighborhood now, but I think in 5, 10, 15 years,
right.
we will see quite a transition in that core area of town.
Seeing it right now, in all honesty, with the engine house going up, every time I go by it, it looks like it's coming up. You know, so I believe this will be a 10-month process, the general plan, and residents can expect it to be about one meeting per month if they were to get involved.
Yes, yeah, so we are aiming for completion of the project by July of 2025, and we're looking for residents who have time to commit to maybe... 1 to 4 hours each month to help us facilitate these neighborhood discussions and also to help us facilitate community engagement in the project as a whole.
So, it comes next July, this is adopted. How does it become implemented? How does all that work pay off?
So the general plan really sets the vision, the goals, the strategies to implement, and then it's really going back to our land management code mm-hmm. and amending that code to implement the recommendations. And we're really hoping that as part of this process, we have really clear strategies that we can implement within certain timeline to update our land management code comprehensively.
Yeah, and I also wanted to mention the role, at least from my perspective, how I see the general plan being used, by planning commissioners when they're reviewing these high-level projects and they talk about, what is written in the general plan. Why is that kind of referenced? Why is that seen as an important document when making kind of some important decisions?
So the general plan is really a policy guide. It's our guiding document for land use. And so it is something that the Planning Commission references. Mm-hmm. It's something that planning staff, as well as the developers and property owners who come in to develop their property, it gives us an idea of what the anticipated built environment for the neighborhood mm-hmm. is. And so the Planning Commission does reference the general plan. It can also be referenced by City Council, our Historic Preservation Board, and then really where it can be enforced is through a land management code that reflects the goals of the plan.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else you want to mention, Rebecca?
We would love to hear from residents who are interested in participating in the neighborhood advisory committees. We do have a project website. It's engageparkcity.com/general plan. And we look forward to engaging with the community throughout this project.
I think it's October 25th. I saw was the deadline. I don't know if you have it.
Friday, October 5th at 5 p.m.
Okay.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Rebecca, for coming in.
Thank you, Parker.
Yeah, we've been speaking with Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward about the general plan update. Well, the Park City School District passed a no cell phone policy in August and reports there is early evidence that it's fostering a kinder school environment. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
The District Board of Education voted to ban cell phones after months of conversations with Park City parents, and a survey found 85% of teachers and parents support a no cell phone policy. Although it's still early in the school year, Interim Superintendent Caleb Fine says staff say they've seen noticeable differences, especially at Treasure Mountain Junior High and Ecker Hill Middle School. He says conversations between students are not as cell phone based.
At Treasure and at Ecker, where there's no cell phones allowed, and even in the hallways or the cafeterias, you see those conversations being, you know, kinder, more gracious.
Fine also said there has been a noticeable decrease in incidents of bad behavior at Treasure. Each school is handling the no cell phone policy differently. Ecker students must keep their phones in a backpack or locker, while Treasure students must keep their phones in locked yonder pouches. Park City High School students can use their phones in between classes, and teachers decide if they can use them during class. Fine said each school is tailoring its approach based on the ages of its students. For example, Fine said Ecker students have higher rates of compliance with the no cell phone policy.
There's a compliance level that is a little bit more natural at that age development. I think students are a little less addicted and a little less reliant on the phone.
However, some of the positive changes could be related to other district initiatives. Fine says the district has implemented the Move This World curriculum in its elementary schools. The curriculum helps integrate social and emotional skills with short, age-appropriate videos. At Treasure and Ecker, students are learning how to spot and prevent harassment and discrimination during advisory classes, as well as how to create healthy relationships. Fine said at the high school, the focus is on preventing anti-Semitism, racism, and sexism.
If our goal is zero, which it is, it's my goal, it's zero incidents of this, then we just can't stop. We just have to continue to teach, continue to tweak our lessons to keep them fresh and new for students, and continue to keep it at the forefront of their mind.
Fine said the district is tracking the number of harassment and discrimination reports in schools to see what impact the cell phone policy and other initiatives have on school communities over time. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In other news, Caring Bridge, a national nonprofit health platform that supports caregivers and patients, is hosting two fundraisers in Utah this week. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Park City resident Christy Lindquist is a new board member to the organization that's been around for nearly 20 years. She says the platform was invaluable as she found herself one of the unfortunate users of Caring Bridge.
I was a caregiver for about 2.5 years for my late husband. And honestly, it was a lifeline for me. I had lived abroad for about 15 years and had friends from all over the world. And it was just the way that I could keep connected and let everyone know what the status was, but also to gain support. And I got so many words of encouragement and help through that site.
The platform is free to use, and health update posts can either be public or private. Family members and friends can join the site to get valuable information directly from the sources. Additionally, she says it helps a caregiver manage a very challenging situation and get the help they need.
What happens as a caregiver is, you know, loving and very well-meaning people want to know what's going on, but you get inundated with requests, and really it becomes an obligation that you need to answer people, and this is a way to keep everyone involved and get their support where you need it.
Caring Bridge is funded via small donations that it asks for when a user logs onto the site. But with 2.5 billion visits a year and more than 300,000 people on the site every day, she says the staff of just 42 needs additional financial support to keep the site operating. Two fundraisers are set for Utah, one in Salt Lake on Tuesday at Kiln at the Gateway Center. A second one is set for Park City on Wednesday, October 9th at the Kimball Terrace from 5 to 7 p.m. Park City resident Anthony Burke will be a guest speaker at both events. He says Caring Bridge was a huge support when his wife Mary, a KPCW DJ, was diagnosed with cancer at the age of 37 with three children under the age of 7.
We felt suddenly very alone and very confused, and it was amazing the way our community came together to support us, even so much that community members signed up to bring us dinner 5 nights a week. Still makes me emotional. And so this idea that Caring Bridge can provide support for people in need really resonated with me, and especially as now as I have aging parents, and it feels like I'm going through this journey again.
There is no cost to attend the fundraisers, but donations will be requested. For more information, send an email to info@caringbridge.org. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
And Powder Mountain has made some big changes for the coming ski season, including privatizing some established public lifts and adding four new lifts. They've also raised pass prices while dropping its cap on season passes and implemented paid parking on weekends and holidays. The Salt Lake Tribune reports season pass holders say they were blindsided when an email from the Eden Ski Resort informed them the area will require paid parking this season. The resort plans to charge $12 per car on weekends and holidays until 1 p.m. at all lots. Parking is free Monday through Friday and for those with three or more people in the car. Powder Mountain operators said they forewarned season pass holders that parking changes were afoot. In an interview with the Tribune in March, Powder Mountain General Manager Kevin Mitchell said the resort would be dropping its 3,000-person cap on season passes and would be tinkering with its parking rules. Season pass holders do get free transit to the mountain on the UTA ski bus, and a spokesperson said the resort is working to coordinate frequent shuttles.